the hit Paramount Plus original docuseries returns.
The last time I saw Max, he looked at us laughing, and then everything changed in a blink of an eye.
My feeling as a detective is that he was murdered.
Yahoo Entertainment calls it a spine-chilling docuseries showcasing real-life tragedies.
What about when your child who went missing?
We need to know the truth.
Never seen again. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
What's up? Welcome to Barton and Bud. I am Barton. Barton Simmons, he is Bud. Bud Elliott. And we're excited to get away from the stresses and anxiety of the real world right now and talk college football and college football recruiting. We know it's crazy times, and our thoughts are with everyone struggling out there right now, whatever you are struggling with. And we hope that you can get away a little bit and let college football kind of get your mind off things. Bud, how are things going?
Going well, man. I was like you said, our thoughts are with everybody, and we hope we all get through this and we come out of it for the better. Also going well, the podcast is going pretty well. 328 five-star ratings now. Got a lot of new questions. Numbers have been good. We continue to grow every month, which is awesome, especially as y'all start to go back to work and you're listening to us on your commute. And we have a pretty good show for everybody today. Quickly an update here. 950 commits, man, so far. That is that's a lot. Last year at this time, 405. 950, 405.
Yeah. So we're about to hit like the point where there's a finite number of commitments available in the class. And so at some point this has to taper down a little bit, but you know, June was a big month in 2019 that a bunch of commits come in. It typically is. A lot of these recruiting events are held. Coaches start pushing for commits. Guys go to camp. So I would imagine the same sort of mentality from college coaches is there in terms of pushing for commits. And I imagine a lot still keep rolling in. But June might be where things start to peak a little bit, because at some point, you know, the things have to come back down to earth, and you know, the classes start to fill up. I mean, shoot, Tennessee's got like 25 commits right now, and they feel like they're still like pushing the pedal to the floor.
So here's a question: Will any team reach 30 plus verbal commits at one time this year? Because I was going back and I was working on a project this morning on Ohio State's recruiting class. Like, if they just stopped right now, where would their class rate all time? And they actually, if they did, they'd basically average like a final ranking of 2.5 in the team recruiting rankings. If Ohio State just said, no, we're good, we're done for the rest of the year, we'll take our 301 points and go home. But I was looking, man, we got some years. Like, Miami had a year where they signed 32 kids. Bama signed 32 kids. I think Ole Miss with like Houston Nutt signed like 36, 37 one year. This used to be a thing. There's a rule for how many you can sign now, but there's no rule for how many verbal commits you can have at any one time. So I'm going to ask you, do you think any school out there will hit 30, you know, verbal commits at one point?
Hell, Tennessee may hit 30 by the time this pod's over. I mean, at the rate they're going. I think this might be the year. This might be because you're basically, if you do hit 30 commits, you're basically acknowledging some of you guys ain't going to be here in a couple weeks. Like, look around the room. If you haven't talked to the coach in a while, it's probably you. I think this could be a year where that happens. Cause look, we're going to have a lot of turnover, but there's probably a lot of coaches that are accounting for turnover. There's probably some kids that they might even see the writing on the wall and understand like, okay, we had them committed in September, or I'm sorry, in April, but September's here. Travel restrictions have been lifted. He's taking visits all over the place. He hadn't returned my calls. Let's go ahead and take the backup plan and wait and get that decommitment going. So, there's going to be all kinds of storylines in the decommitment cycle this year.
I'm all about it. So we'll talk recruiting a little more later in the show. But first, I want to get to a cool topic that you brought up. And I was like, yeah, let's jump on this. Let's do it. What schools do we think are best equipped to sort of weather the quarantine offseason and actually come out and maybe be a little bit better than they're expected to be because of the factors that might make a team good at a quarantine offseason, or at least not as negatively impacted. I don't know if everybody's good at it, but I think there's some schools that are less negatively impacted about it than other schools are. And so let's go ahead and jump into that here. It's a fascinating concept. I know you did a lot of work on this, coming up with sort of criteria that might make a school good. And then once we lay out those criteria, we can go ahead and talk about some schools that we think really fit.
So the criteria that I established, and this is sort of a working list. So maybe there's some things that you add. Maybe there's some things that as we talk through this, we come up with that is different. But like my sort of tent poles for the criteria are experienced roster returning, basically a roster that can self-police, that can sort of keep itself in check, has the have an identity. They know who their leaders are. Those sort of things I think are important in this sort of a setting, because, you know, think about it, like spring practice, spring conditioning, that's when the new leaders emerge. That's when new faces step to the forefront and push teammates and keep guys on task. And when you're not around each other, it's just, that's harder to develop that sort of identity leadership. So I think if you got experience returning on the roster, that's critical. I think an obvious one here is just, you know, is there a coaching change or an administration change? Like, I don't even necessarily count, like, for instance, you know, Memphis lost Mike Norvell, but they promoted Ryan Silverfield. We're talking strictly about Power Five in this conversation, but like that to me isn't necessarily a big negative on Memphis, because there's continuity sort of in the regime. So sure. Continuity in the regime at the head coach position, and then schematic, like there's offensive scheme, defensive scheme. That can mean, you know, Mike Gundy has a new offensive coordinator, but I think his scheme is going to be the same. Still, that's not going to change. Defensive coordinator change, defensive scheme change, whatever the case may be. Like, that's obviously a little less time to at least put that into practice in the spring and in 7-on-7s and things like that. I know they're doing the Zoom meetings, but that's still has its limitations. The quarterback position, and you sort of. I don't know how much you're on board with the quarterback position. I think it's partially like in just in terms of teams returning a quarterback in standard years. You kind of made a point when we were talking in Slack that like that's less important than maybe some other areas than people realize. I would argue maybe, and I could be wrong here, but maybe the quarterback position this cycle is a little bit amplified because of, again, the idea of having your leader in place, having your sort of offensive general there that is you know, that everyone can point to, have confidence in, knows who they are. And then those are sort of the primary ones. And then with those sort of in place, as you sort of weed out who checks all those boxes, I think then you can get into some things like, how much spring practice did they have? What is the dynamic in the state where they reside, where the school is, in terms of their access to workout facilities and access to the players and things of that nature? And then you could even extend it beyond that to some other sort of more minutia, which I think is a little harder to sort of grasp, but. That those were sort of the primary sticking points for me. Is there anything you would kind of add to that grocery list?
You know, I not really. I think you pretty much nailed it.
The one thing you mentioned in Slack, which I started to sort of, again, I used to sort of weed out a couple of the top contenders, is not just returning production, but returning offensive production.
Yeah. So yeah, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot. I just sort of upon the idea, like, I think it's harder and to get the offense going than it is the defense going relative to talent, right? Defense, I'm not going to say that it's not a team game, obviously, because I do believe it's a team game, but it's not quite as much of like an interrelated team game as offense is. Offense is a little more chemistry based. Defense is a little more effort, you know, pursuit based. And I think that is often why we see defenses be far ahead of offenses in the spring and also in early games in the fall. I mean, look back at Florida and Miami to open the year last year. Now, Miami's offense never really got going. Florida's actually turned into a pretty quality offense, but they both look like crap on opening night. And that's often the case when we see those games, especially those Labor Day games. Schools just have not had enough reps, even with a normal summer, even with spring practice, even with your fall camp. They just have not had enough chemistry and reps together to get going. So I do feel like if you're trying to break in a new offense this year, if you have a lot of new pieces on offense, I'm probably going to downgrade you. I haven't really figured out how much yet. Or if you have a lot of returning pieces on offense, I'm probably going to excuse if your almost entire defense is gone. I'm going to put a lot of faith in the returning production on offense, assuming that it was actually, you know, quality players. If you sucked last year and everybody's back, it's like, okay, well, I mean, great. You have continuity of suckage, I guess. But I think that's going to matter. And I have some teams who actually maybe don't fit all the criteria that you have, but I'm still going to kind of stump for them anyway, just because I feel like they return so much on offense and should be pretty good there.
All right. So where should we start here? Should we start? You may start at the bottom.
Can we get the teams that are real
that just don't check any boxes.
Yeah. Yeah. We can.
All right. So here's a few of them at the very bottom of the list here. Vanderbilt, returning production, 71st in the country. Returning production, we use Bill Conley's, or I did. I assume you did too, but I did. I used Bill Conley's returning production that he puts on ESPN. And Vanderbilt returned 71, is 71st in the country among FBS programs in returning production. That's not terrible. Below average, but not terrible. And they do return their head coach. But they have a new offensive coordinator, a new defensive coordinator, a quarterback that wasn't on the roster last year. We don't even know who the starting quarterback will be because he wasn't on the roster last year and is one of like four guys. And by the way, the offense is like a total shift in like philosophy, like just philosophically, it's just a totally different deal. And then the other thing that I forgot to mention up front is I talk about just culture, just how strong is the culture, which is obviously the most subjective, but I think just in terms of like the teams that just you can just count on from a consistency standpoint, that have some sort of fabric to them that is, you know, you sort of can count on it year in, year out. I think that's going to be a big benefit in this cycle. And Vanderbilt, I don't know you can say that about Vanderbilt because there's been tons of turnover in their coaching staff consistently. And I'm not like there's no issues off the field there, but you know, I don't know that you can sort of give them that checkbox either. The other ones are all new coaches. Washington State, again, totally new system and doesn't check any of the other boxes. Probably including the culture. We can talk about that one from. I mean, they're getting in fights before bowl games last year. Like, I don't know if we're, you know, if we can really give them a checkbox there either. I'm sorry, that was Mississippi State. Washington State is. We might be able to say they have a good culture, but they've, you know, new system, new coach, 85th in returning production. Mississippi State was the other one I was talking about. Again, air raid system being implemented. Colorado, they got hired extremely late, no spring practice, you know, barely hired a staff in time before the pandemic. And then Michigan State, who's 117th in the country in returning production and doesn't check any of the boxes with the, like, would typically check the culture box with Mark D'Antonio there, but I don't know that you can give them that checkbox with a new coaching staff in place. Like, what does that even mean? So those five are in bad shape in terms of like what you would expect them to do based on, you know, what their our standard expectation would be and how it changes given the pandemic circumstances.
So I agree with all those. I'm actually going to hit you with two more stats on Vanderbilt, and we're not trying to pile on Vanderbilt. I know we've basically already fired Derek Mason on this show because we did the, you know, the segment last week about like who should be Vanderbilt's coach if they're going to have success, and it's not Derek Mason. And I am somewhat convinced that some of these defensive head coaches are just, they're not able to coach a team as a head coach that fosters a quality offense. I don't know if it's the way that they run practice. I don't know if it's that they keep their thumb on their offensive coordinator, but there are some guys who are defensive-minded head coaches. Just like I almost wonder if there's some offensive head coaches who just cannot field a good defense. Maybe it's how they run their practice or whatever. And I think there's two in the SEC East, right? Will Muschamp, it seems incapable of having good offenses, almost no matter which coordinators he hires. Derek Mason, their average finish in offensive SP Plus after six seasons is 81st. Like, that's not even in the Power Five. Like, they 81st is horrendous for an SEC team to be finishing 81st consistently on offense. Now, here's the other thing. You mentioned that they are, what, 71st in returning production? Did you peep where they are in returning offensive production?
I am aware. Like, when I looked at that number, I was thinking, like, the defense has got a lot of guys coming back. Defense could be decent, but where are they at offense?
122nd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a bad balance in these times.
So I've got some other ones for you here. Obviously Colorado was like a glaring like red flag. It's like, oh God, this is bad. Missouri, 111th in returning offensive production, coaching change, new quarterback, a lot of stuff going on there. Michigan is actually 119th. I'm not quite as worried about them because I think they check a lot of other boxes, you know, for me.
Right.
Oregon is 124th in returning offensive production. Now, maybe some of the guys they lost weren't Justin Herbert was obviously very good, but maybe some of the receivers they lost were not that good. I don't think the receivers really scared anybody last year over the recent years. And then there's a team who had a pretty good season last year, LSU, 128th in returning offensive production, which is going to happen when you lose like every single person you have to the NFL draft. But like Oregon and LSU, they have new offensive coordinators, right? Because Arroyo went to what, UNLV, mm-hmm. and Brady's with the Panthers now.
Now, granted, LSU does, they have the same offensive coordinator.
Sure, that's right.
But I don't think you can just sort of brush off the departure of Joe Brady considering the impact he had on that offense. But Bo Pelini, new defensive coordinator, is going to bring in a new scheme for LSU. And I do think keep in mind, so it's not as if in us bringing up LSU, we think that LSU is going to be bad in the, you know, relative to the college football nationally. But the idea here is like, look, if you think LSU, this LSU team in a standard offseason is 11-1, well, given that LSU has like new schematic issues to deal with offensively and defensively, new quarterback, loses tons of production, and we'll have sort of a harder time building the cohesiveness and leadership that they would have typically built in a typical offseason. Like, what do you dock them? Like, the idea is like maybe that instead of 11-1, they're 10-2 or 9-3. Maybe instead of 10-2, they're 9-3 or 8-4. Like, I don't know. I'm just saying like that this exercise is sort of about adjusting from what your typical expectation is going to be for a team. So, you know, if I think most of our listeners are going to be from the gambling tribe, and this will be the type of thing I think you may want to just factor into your season win totals bets once we go through this.
I think you have to. In fact, I think that a lot of the lines that have already been out there that we're not allowed to reference due to our corporate relationships have already been shifting quite a bit, probably because some bettors are already factoring these in. Let's go ahead and shift here. Speaking of shifts, from some teams that maybe have some real red flags in this category to some teams who maybe aren't going to be like national title contenders, possibly. Maybe they are. But some teams who probably are pretty well equipped to weather the storm for a variety of reasons.
Okay. So I've identified like my top two.
Okay.
And I may work myself up to that. So here's the top tier, excluding my top two. All right. My top tier, let me know if any of these were schools that you identified to. All right. I've got Wisconsin, Kentucky, Penn State, Iowa State, Florida, and TCU. So basically, all those are just sort of rock solid. Like same head coach, same offensive system, same defensive system, quarterback returning with experience and a strong culture. And TCU had the worst returning production of that group, 64th in the country. Florida not far ahead at 61st. Iowa State 52nd, Penn State 47th, Wisconsin 34th, Kentucky 25th. So all those, you know, not like out the park in terms of returning production, but no, again, no real issues there. And so those are the schools that like consistently I think based on the circumstances, there's a level of trust I have with what they'll be able to put together in the offseason.
So I have a couple of those. I think Florida makes a lot of sense. Penn State, certainly. I mean, two really good head coaches, I think, in Florida and Penn State. Wisconsin, the same. And I'm fairly bullish on TCU. I'm kind of driving this TCU bandwagon this year. I didn't have Iowa State. I don't really know why I didn't. I mean, I'm looking through, you know, sort of what I was doing here. And maybe I should have had Iowa State.
So Iowa State,
they fit. Yeah.
Yeah. The argument there, you know, like Matt Campbell's built a strong culture. They're consistent. You know, they haven't had their breakthrough year yet, but they right off the jump have been like an 8-win-ish team under Matt Campbell. And they have Brock Purdy coming back. They have, they have a lot returning. And they've got, you know, pretty rock solid coordinators and coaching and a coaching staff. So they're, again, it's more about finding teams that don't have that, like, that glaring weakness, and these are the teams that just check all the boxes.
So I have a couple that you didn't mention. I want to bounce them off you, kind of get your thoughts on them. So Cal, Nebraska, Northwestern, and North Carolina. All right. Now, one of those teams had a really good offense last year. Two of those teams had a horrendous offense last year, and one of them had an offense that was, I would say, okay, but just not up to standard. Like, or not up to expectation, that would be Nebraska. But all four of those teams are in the top 10 nationally in returning offensive production. And there are some teams that I feel like have a good chance to steal some wins early this year if they can get off to a good start. Just because of their ability to score points or score more points than we think they otherwise might score early in the year when some teams are struggling. We know Northwestern and Cal are going to play really good defense. We don't know that Nebraska's going to play really good defense, but am I stupid for trusting Scott Frost, you think, to put up points here? Because I think the guy can coach offense, and I think Adrian Martinez is going to have a bounce back year there at Nebraska. And North Carolina could just come out the gate really hot. I think they have to worry about UCF getting them, because UCF returns, you know, just about as much production as they do, and they have to go to Orlando, I believe, to play them. And I'm going to pick UCF in that game probably, but those are four teams that really kind of stand out to me. And also like Illinois and Minnesota, who return a ton on offense. Although I have some questions about Minnesota's defense, and those are the kind of six that really stood out to me.
Yeah. So I've got sort of a tier two, a group of tier two teams that are just maybe missing one thing. And included in that group is North Carolina, Illinois, Cal, and Nebraska.
Okay.
So I'm with you on those. Like, I think Nebraska is like they as I went through the exercise, that was one of the teams that I didn't necessarily expect to like see. And really the only thing that I don't have as a big check box for Nebraska is culture. And it's not that I think the culture is bad there. It's just that we're 2 years in. We don't really like, we can guess, and I would guess that the culture is strong there, and that this is built to last, and you know, things have taken hold, but we don't really know. 2 years haven't been had a bowl yet season yet. You know, we know what Scott Frost can do at UCF, but like, it's just a question mark for me on that. The same thing with North Carolina. You can, if you make an assumption that North Carolina is like really has a firm footing in terms of the way that locker room is built, the just the identity and the culture that's in place in just whatever it's been 18 months since Mac Brown's been there, then yeah, they're a tier one group. So those are the two for sure that I'm right there with. And then I think the other one, like the one that's really interesting to me that you mentioned, I think Northwestern is such a fit for this exercise, like in a subjective way. Like if we're just going purely by the book, they do have a new offensive coordinator. They do have a new quarterback, but the new quarterback is like a huge additive to what yeah. they were horrible at quarterback last year, and they're getting a quarterback that is proven to be at the very least decent. The transfer from Indiana,
Peyton Ramsey. Yeah.
So again, you could also have like a huge criticism towards what Northwestern's offense looked like last year due to Mick McCall, their offensive coordinator, who did a great job of getting quarterbacks to the NFL, but did a terrible job of running an offense last year. And Mike Bajakin, who's their new offensive coordinator, comes from BC. Yes, he doesn't have the spring to install his system, but I think we can probably safely assume that will be an upgrade from last year. So Northwestern doesn't sort of just fit in the model of the very analytical way to handle it. But in terms of just looking at the way this team can respond, I think is really encouraging, especially when you consider that, like, when you think about like a culture and a team that's just going to get the most out of its roster. And I mean, Pat Fitzgerald has absolutely proven that we can trust Northwestern in that regard.
So my only real worries about Northwestern are, and I like a lot of their coaching staff. I think that they have one of the best offensive line coaches in the game. My only real worry here is I do believe that the teams who are willing to sort of push the limits on what they did during coronavirus, right? Like the teams that are willing to send Apple Watches to all their players and have the gall to tell us it's to study their sleep, right? And not their athletic performance and stuff like that. You know, I think those teams will have an advantage. Northwestern, I think, has great culture. I think they have very smart kids. A lot of their kids actually have means, so I'm not really worried about them getting nutrition, right? Like a lot of their kids are probably not struggling financially to get quality calories, which is another plus. But man, do I hear a lot of complaining about Northwestern's compliance people and how they are just super strict. And so if Northwestern were to underachieve relative to what we think they can do, it wouldn't surprise me if that's part of it. If it's like if Northwestern really did the nerd thing and they followed exactly by the book, you know, they talk 2 hours to their kids per week and nothing more, you know, and they video recorded all their Zoom calls, their compliance people could watch it, all that kind of stuff. That would be my one worry there with Northwestern. Now with Cal, I think Cal actually could have a pretty good year. You remember they lost, was it Garbers, their quarterback last year? And when Garbers went out, I mean, the backup couldn't play. He was, I forgot what game it was. It might have been, I forget who they were playing, but like it was just really obvious. Oh gosh, like this kid, the backup cannot play at all and they're screwed. Do you worry about where, like their location and where most of their players live hurting Cal a little bit? Like that's kind of one of the things here that they have so much returning production, but yet, California has been in shutdown mode for a long time, and they were shut down earlier than some other places too.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know because I still obviously with, I just don't know how, not living in California. I don't know how much of a faux pas, how taboo it is to be out on your high school field, working out with your teammates or something on your own. I can certainly envision that happening. And I know the gyms, the LA Fitness or whatever might have been closed, but you know, these guys typically find ways to get to some equipment. So I just don't, it's hard for me to know how locked down it has been. I'd be curious, you know, anyone that lives in California, what the dynamic is like for people trying to get a workout in. But I think that's a fair thing to consider when we're going through this process, is who is having an opportunity to get with their players, who's having an opportunity to for their players to work out. Like Nebraska, that's another benefit to Nebraska. Nebraska has very little as a state. The COVID pandemic has not really impacted the state. The Nebraska as a team has been able to get food to their players who are still on campus. And a lot of guys have remained on campus apparently. And so like there's some little underlying benefits that aren't quite as obvious that a lot of these schools are experiencing. And obviously conversely, some underlying, obstacles as well.
Absolutely. So one other name we got to hit you with probably here, unless you have more.
I got two. I still have my number one and two seeds.
Oh, okay.
For the whole deal.
So A&M?
No, but A&M was in, they were in my second tier.
Okay. A&M returns, like they're 16th in Bill Conley's overall returning production. They're 17th in returning production on offense. I mean, we know the stats here, right? 19 returning starters, including quarterback Kellen Mond. They've recruited well. There's a good chance some of those returning starters don't even end up as starters because they're probably going to get beaten out by guys who are more talented, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, I don't fully trust them. Check an article out later this week on 24/7 Sports for maybe why, right? I think they may be able to take the next step, but I have a little bit of doubt about A&M. And yet, I mean, same offensive coordinator, same defensive coordinator, a ton of returning starters, all the money in the world, so there's no reason to think that their players don't have access to, you know, calories and equipment. They're in a red state, which didn't have the same lockdown stuff as maybe some of these states that we worry about. I mean, by your COVID checklist, is there anything they're missing?
Yeah, so I held to get into the first tier, because remember, like North Carolina checked all the boxes, Nebraska checked all the boxes. I didn't check the culture box. And again, it's not because I don't think they have strong cultures, but it's because to get into that top tier, I needed the like the culture to be a no doubt thing, like a thing that's considered a strength. Like when I think about the consistency of Iowa State and Penn State and Wisconsin, like, you know, they have a strong culture. Like Kentucky, for them to sort of cycle up in the SEC East and do it in the way they have with the obstacles they face, you know, they have a strong culture. Florida, Dan Mullen, and really just almost like, but just consistently, like that program is going to be ready for big games. And TCU, you know, Gary Patterson has proven that over time, that they've got a strong culture. So again, it's not a no, like it's not that Texas A&M doesn't have a strong culture. It's just that I don't know. What are we in year three of Jimbo Fisher? I don't know yet if I'm at the point where I like trust it as a strength of the program. Well, yeah, maybe we'll find out this year, but you're right. They do check every other box. And so that was the only thing that just sort of gave me hesitation to put it in the top tier.
That's fair. I mean, they took a little step back last year. The schedule was really crazy. One thing we do know, but it is very difficult to imagine an easier schedule for them in Jimbo's contract tenure, his tenure guaranteed deal, if the divisions don't change, right? Like, you're not going to draw, what do they get, Vanderbilt and South Carolina, I think it is, this year from the East. I mean, that's the draw. That's the one that you want. And LSU lost every single player in the starting lineup to the NFL. You know, Bama doesn't have Tua anymore. Auburn lost Derek Brown and Marlon Davidson and all those dudes to the league. Like, there's a – I don't want to say something stupid that's going to become a soundbite here, but there is a chance. I'm not going to say it's a great chance, but there's a chance that this is the best opportunity they get to win the SEC under Jimbo, schedule-wise. Yeah,
I think that's an interesting and fair, like, take. Yeah, like they check all the boxes in a non-COVID era, and they check the boxes even more so in a COVID era. And so, Yeah, this has got to be a year where they hit. I mean, 16th in the country. And what was their, what's their offensive returning production?
17th.
17th. So, like, you know, and defense has been really steady since Mike Elko has arrived. There's lots of, like, I mean, A&M's, but this is if they don't do it this year, that makes it even that much tougher to swallow, because like A&M just seemingly just can't get over that hump, and now it's almost like this has got to be the year they get over the hump.
If they don't do it this year, some documentary crew is going to produce a really good documentary going down there and figuring out like why a school with this many resources and access to talent can't seem to get over the hump in 100 years.
Yeah.
Couple more that I wanted to throw out before we get to your tier ones. I'm pretty sure these will not be your tier ones. Well, I think one might be USC, obviously, to me, but like they lack some culture stuff and there's right. some questions there, but like they could score on people early and often. I mean, I think like they might give Bama a little more run than Bama realizes. We'll see just because of when that game is played. I think Louisville with Scott Satterfield has really good culture. I mean, it, 1 year is maybe a little too short to totally evaluate that, but they look pretty good to me. And here's another one for you. How about Pitt? I trust Pat Narduzzi to have a good to very good defense. I think the coverages they play, maybe they don't have the back end personnel to do it. And it's like, wait a second, man, like it's not Michigan State. Last year, their offense took a weird step back. They couldn't really run the ball as well. They had to throw it all the time with Kenny Pickett. This year, they return a lot more on offense. I think they'll be better on the offensive line. I was going through my ACC Coastal things, and I was surprised at how high I had Pitt. I think Pitt has a chance to be live in the coast. Not going to pick them, but I think that they have a shot, and they do return quite a bit on offense as well. So let's get your thoughts on those and your tier ones.
Yeah, I like my tier ones. I'm being a little bit confused in the way I'm addressing it. My tier ones are the Kentucky, Wisconsin, Penn State, Iowa State, Florida, TCU, and then there's two in that group that I haven't discussed yet that I think are maybe even just like 1A. My tier twos include, I do have Pitt in there. I have Texas A&M in there. I have Nebraska, Cal, Illinois, North Carolina, we've talked about. There's also Clemson, Ohio State. I have Indiana, Virginia Tech, Tennessee, Stanford. And you could make a case for Stanford in tier one if you actually look at it. They're 28th in returning production. Turn their head coach. Same systems offensively and defensively. Quarterback Davis Mills returns, even though he kind of split time last year with an injured KJ Costello. The question to me is like, is it still this, like 2 years ago, the culture's a no doubt thing there. I just don't know. Like I've got some identity issues with Stanford these days in terms of like what they want to be offensively and just sort of, that's been a little bit harder for me to nail down for me to give them that tier one status. And then the last one I had was UCLA. And again, the only thing missing there in terms of just the checklist is, I mean, Chip Kelly has not proven he's built a culture to last yet. Not saying he hadn't, but he hadn't proven it yet. So, but yes, I think Pitt is absolutely like, you know, checks the boxes in a lot of ways. And I've been very tempted because I think what they did last year in their offensive coordinator hire, taking the former head coach at UMass, whose name I'm blanking on right now,
Mark Whipple.
I think that helped a lot. I think, you know, I think that was a negative for them prior to Whipple. And I liked sort of what they looked like offensively, especially like you said, cause they couldn't really run the ball. So they kind of had to make do. And defensively, this is like, finally saw a Pat Narduzzi defense started coming to its own last year. And like look like a Pat Narduzzi defense, and they're loaded on the defensive line this year, or they're deep, I should say, on the defensive line this year. And I think that they're, you know, defensively it'll be another good year. So I'm with you on Pitt as well. So here's my top two teams from a, and again, this is just in terms of like if you expect them to go 7-5, then maybe they'll go 9-3. But it's, you mentioned one of them, Louisville, and the other one's Oklahoma State. I'm just telling, hey, everything's aligning for Oklahoma State this year. This is, Well, I can't remember if I've talked about it with you on this pod, but there's a reason why Mike Gundy back in whenever it was, April, got on his press conference and started talking about how he needs his guys. He wants to get his guys back in May 1st.
We did talk about this. Oh, yeah. Okay. Like we said the real reason behind his comments is that he knows he's got something this year. Like, let's go.
Hell yeah.
Like, this is.
He's ninth in the country in returning production. That includes, you know, returning a starting quarterback. That's 34th in the country in returning offensive production, which is pretty good. But fortunately, like, that's not even really where they typically need the help. The defensive production is where they're like a top, I don't know if you got in front of you, but I think they're top 20 in defensive production returning.
Yeah. And they're, yeah. So they're ninth overall, they're 34th in offensive production. So their defensive production is rock solid. And I mean, if you give me 34th in offensive production and you give me a quarterback back and is Chuba gone?
No, Chuba's back.
No, Chuba's back. That's right.
And Tyler Wallace back. You got the Dylan Stoner kid, I think, is back at receiver. Like, they're loaded at the receiving position. Like,
they got a good transfer on the offensive line, Josh Sills from West Virginia, who was an all-conference guy at one point.
They've got scheme continuity with – they're losing an offensive coordinator, but it's still Gundy's system. And they just promoted from within in terms of the next offensive coordinator up. Their defensive coordinator returns, Jim Knowles. So now he's had – I think last year was his first year, I want to say. And so now he's got sort of his feet under him there. And – again, you can trust the culture there because Oklahoma State is like consistently flirting with 10 wins year in, year out. It doesn't, you kind of interchangeably speaking. So this is, and they got a couple practices in spring practice. That doesn't hurt. They didn't get them all in, but they got, I think, two or three maybe. And so things are looking up. And then my last one, which is another one that you actually mentioned, but Louisville, they got, they're 13th in returning production, I think 20-something and 21 in offensive production. They return the quarterback, return their head coach, pretty much the same coaching staff, top to bottom. So same scheme. And again, I know I've sort of like not given early coaches the benefit of the doubt on culture, but I feel like culture is just sort of Scott Satterfield specialty. Like,
yeah,
they took a 2-10 team to 8 wins. Like, that's the idea. Like, if for you to do that in the first year after those guys were so beaten down, like, the buy-in is off the charts for you to like turn that team around like that. Like, there's no one questioning anything in there. Like, they're all on the same page. So I think you can give them the culture check. And then this is another team that I couldn't figure out how many spring practices they got in, but I think they got in a pretty like significant, meaningful chunk of spring practice before the quarantine. So there's a lot to like about Louisville heading into the year from a pandemic era perspective.
One that I am shocked you didn't have on your list here. And I'm shocked because this is kind of your boy, like their head coach and Indiana, man. Indiana, 11th in returning production. We both like Tom Allen. You really like Tom Allen. I'm pretty sure, yeah, you're the one I listened to the Cover 3. You love Tom Allen, right?
Yes, yes. So they actually, you could make a case that they would be tier one based on the again, just analytical approach. The only thing keeping them, they had one thing keeping them out, because you're right, 11th in returning production, same head coach, defensive continuity, quarterback coming back, who's a really good quarterback coming back. I think you can say the culture is really strong there. The only thing that kept them from being a tier one team for me is they did change offensive coordinators. Now, same system, so the continuity is the same. They just they promoted from within. Nick Sheridan is their new offensive coordinator, but he's a first-time OC. He's really young. And you could make a case that their offensive coordinator last year, who just took the head coaching job at Fresno State, was like a pretty significant difference maker on that team in terms of like the like why they started to cycle up a little bit. So yes, there's a strong case to be made for Indiana, and I still like if I'm just blindly. Like, if you just got blindly, like, you're not even going to tell me what the number is for their win total, but I just got to pick a side over or under, I'm picking over for sure. They just didn't make my tier one. They made my tier two.
I think that makes a lot of sense. When we got some good mileage out of this topic, dude. We are like 45 minutes into this thing. I know we had to recut the intro twice, but this is great.
Let's take a quick break. And on the other side, after that marathon game, we'll talk about some kind of proposed rule changes in the COVID era that might be beneficial to some programs, at least on the recruiting side of things. So we'll talk about that on the other side.
Baseball has begun, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today in 5, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Sample, every Monday through Saturday as we deliver all of your fantasy baseball needs in just 5 minutes. We'll break down the biggest performers, news, and prospects who could make an impact this season. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.
New CBS Monday.
Federal agents!
Hands where we can see them!
NCIS Hawaii is back.
About to set it all on fire!
New criminals to catch.
Armed robbery, aggravated assault, murder.
And new investigations to be solved.
These guys were good, but even masters make mistakes.
Vanessa Lachey and featuring LL Cool J.
Violent Island, you got it.
Welcome to paradise.
A new NCIS Hawaii, Monday, 10, 9 central on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.
All right, welcome back. And now we're going to talk about some of these NCAA rule changes. And Bud, I don't know, why don't you kick us off? What direction do you think this isn't even about predicting where the NCAA is going to go. I think this is more about for us, like, let's just talk about some of the areas maybe we think that they should go in terms of managing the calendar and the rules, given the way things have just been flipped on their head in the time of the pandemic.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of suggestions out there. Obviously, it's something that we discuss internally a lot, like what we think the NCAA should do in the best interest of both players and of schools. And I think there's some ones that really benefit both players and schools as long as you can do them safely, and I assume that you can. So typically in the recruiting calendar, the month of August is a dead period. Now, I don't want to address any kind of changes for June, July, because that's already been decided that it's going to be a dead period, which means no off-campus or on-campus visits, right, until the end of July. It's dead through July 31st by NCAA decree, you know, for the whole COVID thing. But in the normal NCAA calendar, August is also a dead period. So we have lost the majority of March, right, all of April, all of May, all of June, all of July. I mean, you're talking about almost 150 days here of potential scouting, evaluation, relationship building, in, you know, in-person meeting, in-person coaching, camps, that type of stuff. We've lost all that. And my first suggestion would be, instead of having August be a dead period, I think it should be either an evaluation period or at the very least a quiet period. So if it's a quiet period, you can't go to the prospect's high school, but he can come and see you and visit your campus. If it's an evaluation period, you can do both. He can come see you, and you can go see him off campus. The counter to this might be like coaches say, hey, I'm really trying to coach my team. We only have 6 weeks to get ready for the season. I get that, but I don't think, especially if you go with the quiet period option, I really don't think it's going to be that big of a problem to have kids come and visit you during spring practice. In fact, I think most coaches would welcome it because they really want to see, hey, is this 6'1 guy we took? Is he really 6'1? I mean, we did that Tinder swipe a long time ago, and you know the date's a long time coming here. I want to see him roll onto the practice field and just have him stand over next to a couple of our other DBs and see how big he really is. I don't really see a problem there. That's my first suggestion of what they should do, because the rest of the calendar, to me, looks fine. August is a dead period, I think, is overkill.
Yeah, I have heard. I was talking to a coach maybe yesterday, and he was saying something to the effect of like, "Man, they got to keep it a dead period in August because we gotta get ready for the season. Like we've had no time to get ready for the season." But I don't know whether he was dismissing the idea of a quiet period, because that to me does make sense, especially when you think of it, not just in as it relates to the coaches, but as it relates to the prospects. You know, those guys, if they, I mean, look, I guess there's not going to be a ton of visits because they're in their practice as well. But if they could just even get on campus for a weekend or something and get around the coaches and you know, tour the facilities, see the camp. I mean, a lot of these guys are committed to schools they've never been to.
Right.
And so, like I said, like there may not be a ton of travel opportunity in August as is, but if you can squeeze a little bit in, you know, that I think just educating the players on who, what they're signing up for is beneficial. You know, the big one I think that I'd be interested in, and I just think it would be fun to have this added to college personnel departments in a more meaningful way, is just the idea that an off the field guy, because I think this could be potentially be utilized, like sort of made permanent, but designating an off field guy or two to just scouting. Like, you can still have the same restrictions in terms of how much they go visit a school. Like, they can only visit a school once a whatever the rule is. You can only visit school once a month or once in the evaluation period. But have them be able to go out around the country while your coaching staff is still coaching and be your scout, be your regional scout, like an NFL personnel department. And allow those directors of player personnel or those recruiting office personnel to be part of the process for you so that you can make up for all of that lost time in the spring and in the summer that you couldn't get eyes on guys. You couldn't evaluate, you couldn't get height weights, you couldn't get anything. And so, I think that could be beneficial. And like, if it doesn't happen, and if that doesn't happen, I think that there's probably a lot of value in a coaching staff just saying, you know what, we're going to coach a man down all year long. And, you know, we're just, what are we, two years now where they've had 10 assistant coaches?
I think just 1 year.
Just one? Because before that it was 9. And so Just go back to however you operated when it was just 9 and send one of your coaches on the road so that you are making up a lot of lost ground in terms of whatever, whether it's relationships, whether it's discovery process, whether it's evaluation process, or the recruiting process, because there's a little bit of that you can do in there as well. But I think more from just an evaluation standpoint, that's critical to get coaches on the road, even if you got to coach a man down at practice.
And I'm going to let y'all in here on a little secret. If what Barton is proposing doesn't happen, a lot of these schools are going to send that guy on the road. And once the compliance goes back inside because the practice is hot, that analyst who's just observing and helping to coach the coaches is all of a sudden going to maybe take a couple steps over and he's going to start coaching the players. Like that's what happens at most of the big schools. A lot of these schools kind of have that coaching staff and then they have their sort of shadow coaching staff. You know, if you've ever seen practice video, especially if you get it with audio, they have these analysts out there and they're not allowed to coach the players, but they literally coach the coaches in the drill. Like, hey, coach, I would tell 56, you know, to do this. And like, it's really a charade. But I also think, like, we know we have Chris Hummer coming out later this week, I think early next week, one of the two, with something on minority hiring. And allowing coaches to get on the road, I think, in this fashion, or especially interoffice personnel, could help to bring more minority hires into the actual coaching ranks, because these guys are even more valuable because they have the on-the-road experience, which at times can be harder to do because you can't get it right now unless you're actually an on-field coach. So I actually think it could help grow the game and make staffs more diverse. That just popped in my head there thinking about what we have coming up, you know, this week. One thing I wanted to bring up finally, just before we get off this, are you a move early signing period guy?
So I'm a move early signing period guy the reality is, so we have an early signing period where it's a couple years old and coaches have settled into it. And I've talked to a lot of coaches that are indifferent on whether or not there's an early signing period this year. Like they sort of like, look, it's what we've had. We'll stick with it. Like, might as well. But a lot of those same coaches didn't want an early signing period to begin with. And I think the early signing period ultimately is not beneficial. I guess it doesn't maximize the decision-making process for the player. And so given our current climate, given how little the players are educated on where they're signing up for, they're making their decisions. You're talking about schools making decisions based on limited information. Kids are making decisions based on more limited information than ever as well. And so they've got fewer offers, they got fewer opportunities, they've got fewer exposure to the programs that they, you know, potentially could be playing for. I just think if things open up in the fall, from a player's perspective, it makes sense to me to push the early signing period back, delay the process a little bit to let everyone on both sides collect more information. And I think that, look, the reality is a lot of schools would fight back on that, because a lot of schools are going to have a chance to have historic recruiting classes given the circumstances. And a lot of schools are just doing, like, you think Ohio State wants an early signing period? No, they're about to have the best recruiting class of all time. Even though Ohio State, generally speaking, probably is in favor of one signing period, because Ohio State's top of the food chain. But does a program, does Stanford want to delay the early signing period this cycle? I'm not asking anyone at Stanford, but I can't imagine that they wouldn't, because Stanford has to recruit nationally to find guys that can get into school. And so in order to recruit nationally, you need more time and you need more opportunity to see these guys and more evaluation opportunity. And so I'm just more about, like, the idea that, you know, everyone, let's just allow everyone to make a more informed decision. And it might sort of muck things up for a lot of teams and for a lot of programs. And I know that some kids would have to sort of delay a signing longer than they want to because they're ready to get the process over with. But, you know, the best way to get the process over with is stop answering your phone and stop, you know, don't tweet out that you got a new offer. I just think the opportunity to have everyone be more informed would be to have a one signing period in this one cycle.
I'm right there with you. I think you just completely talked me into it. If the way the NCAA said it was supposed to work is actually the way it worked, I would be very pro early signing period. Right. And granted, like, look, for our business, early signing period is pretty awesome. We get two bites at the apple, you know, as opposed to just one. So self-interested here. Yeah, of course we are. You mentioned, by the way, did you look at my drafts today for stories coming up? Because I have a draft, literally, of something that I scheduled to be published on Sunday. Title: Has the early signing period hurt Stanford's recruiting? And I had these quotes from David Shaw in 2014. Shaw, quote, to ESPN: I might be alone in this. I think it's terrible. The reason for early signing period, in my opinion, is coaches don't like when kids commit and switch late. Now, he, of course, admitted to being self-interested, because Stanford oftentimes doesn't actually give kids admission until like January, February. So he goes, I'll be honest here, which is rare for a football coach in a setting like this, but we have a lot of kids that don't know if they're going to get into school until after that early signing day, Shaw said. So we're going to punish the academic schools just because coaches don't want a kid to switch their commitment. By the way, sneaky shade calling certain schools academic schools, which implies other schools are not actually, you know, schools, but I like that. And then he says, quote, that's a kid — he's referring to some guy they got — that's a kid we would never have gotten because someone would have pressured him into forcing him to sign someplace because they say, you don't know if you're going to get into Stanford, so you got to go sign with us. And so I agree. I think a lot of these kids make poor decisions in the early signing period. Additionally, I'm of the opinion the only kids who should be signing in the early period are kids who enroll early, right? Like, if you're that ready to make your decision, also be ready to enroll right then, because so many of these kids get screwed over by these coaches leaving, you know? And that's something that is probably a different topic for a different day. But I mean, how many of these guys got totally crushed when Mel Tucker jumps to Michigan State? I mean, super late. I wonder if
more kids — I don't know. More kids will normalize the idea of staying committed, not taking visits, but just signing in February. Like, just not exploring your process, keeping the options open, but just literally making sure that your head coach is still there in February. Like that's that, because you're right. Like that's what kids should do, but everyone's going through the process the first time.
Exactly.
And so they don't know any better. Like they're, yeah, like it's easy for them to be convinced that, hey man, if you don't sign with us, how are we supposed to know? How are we supposed to know that you're committed to us? So it makes it a tricky to navigate.
Either that, or I mean, there's pro and con on this too. And this is something we won't spend a ton of time on, but the old Paul Johnson thing, right? As soon as you're offered, you're eligible to sign and lock yourself in. That would cut down on the schools who offer 450 kids in a cycle, right? They would be a lot more judicious with their offers. However, a lot of these kids would similarly make bad decisions as soon as they got offered, right? And then can't get out of it because it's binding both ways. So
it would make the news of an offer dramatically different. Like, wow, man, we just sent him an LOI.
Yeah.
All right. What's this kid all about?
You would be like, you would not have 950 commits right now.
No.
You'd have like maybe 200, 250, I think.
And it would be, if they were able to sign right at the time they were offered, that would be interesting to see the creative departments and recruiting offices and how they would publicize those signings too. It'd be a lot of fanfare.
That'd
be wide open, man.
I actually have a proposal I want to talk about on a future show, not the next show, but an upcoming show. I have an NLI proposal that, like, under certain conditions, you get out of your NLI to basically make early signing period still workable, but also still give some freedoms to kids if coaches pull the kind of double cross on them. You want to wrap this one?
Yeah, I think we did all we could do there. Thanks for joining us. Stay safe out there. We'll be back with a mailbag next episode.
CBS Wednesday.
We have so many cool, diverse people from different backgrounds, different beliefs, different upbringings, and it just keeps growing.
I'm a citizen of the United States.
I'm a hustler.
I'm a big Taylor Swift fan.
I'm the queen of the tribe. I'm a
survivor. I am playing whatever role I gotta play.
I'm gonna play this game full speed.
I ain't going down like no punk.
A new Survivor, Wednesday on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.